Hello, everyone. It's Ryan Tripp, returning to the New Native American History and Studies channel for the New Books Network. Today, we have Professor James Brooks. He's a professor of history and anthropology at University of California, Santa Barbara. He's currently actually a visiting fellow at the Robert Penn Warren Center at Vanderbilt University. Welcome, Professor Brooks. So we're just going to dive in here. I'm going to first ask you about the cover. By way of introducing the cover, the U.S. cover at least, during the 1660s, Padre Jose de Espeleta, who appears in the study, quote, devoted intense effort to inculcating in the already ritualistic inclined Hopis a love for choral singing and associated liturgical dramas. According to oral histories, as Navajos herded their sheep and goats beneath the escarpments of Antelope Mesa near Tusayan, Arizona, they marveled at the music drifting down into the canyons and washes. They gave Awat Obi the Navajo name Talahogan, the singing house or place of the singers. Espeleta also most likely served as padrino or godfather to Hopi Badger Clan member Don Francisco, who in turn most likely murdered Espeleta during the 1680 Pueblo Revolt and, later as cacique of Orabay Village, may have dispatched warriors to obliterate Awat Obi on behalf of Tapolo, which we'll discuss that later. In this context, in addition to the wind gusts that you describe elicit a tone from the wires that protect this high place of the Bo clan, why did you select a photo that describes Awat Obi as the singing house for your cover?
That's a great question and a great way into the whole story, actually, Ryan. I appreciate that. For those of your listeners who haven't seen it, that this is a 1915 photograph taken by Alfred Vincent Kidder, who was a leading figure in Southwest archaeology at the time. He may have been returning from his performance at the San Diego Exposition of 1915, in which he had coordinated bringing several members of Puebloan communities in the Southwest to create an Indian living village at the exposition. The timing works out such. It turned out to be not a very good experience for the native people, who felt themselves very exploited and on display. But so he's coming back and apparently stops at the site of Awat Obi and takes several photographs. This is the only one that I've been able to find. But it's situated such that it's focusing on really the only remaining standing architecture at the site in 1915. Remember, this is more than 200 years after the village was destroyed by fellow Hopis. But it's also situated within the church nave of what had been Mission San Bernardo de Awat Obi, that had been established in the 1620s there. And for those of you who have read or will read the book, you'll know that by the end of the book, that church nave is central to trying to understand the enigmatic nature of what went on, what ran up to that moment of violence and obliteration there, in that the church had been largely destroyed 20 years earlier in the Pueblo Revolt, but the church nave and the floor of the nave had continued to be used, even in the absence of Franciscans and any Spaniards, in ways that suggest some kind of continued form of Christian Catholic piety, even in the absence of missionaries, in that the floor of the nave was used as a place for the burial of Hopis who died during that 20-year period. And more than two-thirds, roughly, of the burials that were excavated there in the 1930s were clearly post-revolt, post-destruction interments, which raises a question of just how thoroughly was Christianity obliterated in the Pueblo Revolt of 1680? And what, the even bigger question, what was going on at Owatavie that was so particular that might have called down the destruction of the whole village 20 years later? So that's a good way to leap into the story. I just had told Ryan before the interview began that the French translation of the book is due out in February and features a different cover. It has an historic photographed by Ralph Kuys. It's situated at the living community of Mishongobee and features the entrance to a kiva and perhaps a kiva priest there. Also got a very nice hawk sitting on the ladder of the kiva. But what's most important to me is that the French edition actually has a subtitle that was much closer to the one that I proposed than what I ended up with working with Norton. Norton is a fabulous press, and I learned a lot from my editor, John Glessman, there. But I've been in publishing long enough to know that should have known that authors always lose when marketing departments prefer a different title. So I fought very hard to not have the term massacre in that subtitle, because the whole point of this book is exploration of how different peoples and different positions can see a single event in many different ways. And many, many Hopis today would tell you that that was not a massacre, that that was a act of violent act of purification that was absolutely necessary for Hopi culture to persist. So, but the French edition has the subtitle L'histoire et les fantômes du passé en pays Hopi, history and the ghosts or phantoms of the past in Hopi country, which is much closer to what the intent of the book is. So that's a long response to a question about a photograph, Ryan. Sorry.
It's quite all right. So as our listeners already know from the introductory text, the U.S. title of the book is Mace of Sorrows, A History of the Owatobie Massacre. On that note,
I didn't title it that.
The marketing. We've made that clear here in the introduction. Right? The marketing title.
Well, I understand that I've been a publisher, and I understand that it's, why publish books if you can't sell books? And what they wanted to do was to tie this book into the whole readership and interest group that, for instance, Ari Kelman's Misplaced Massacre, the study of the Sand Creek Massacre, which was a Bancroft-winning book, and Carl Jacoby's Shadows at Dawn, which was an exploration of the Aravaipa Massacre down in Arizona. So I understand their marketing logic, but it bothered me because so much of what the book is about is this puzzle of, is this a massacre or is it an act of purification or is it somehow both?
I appreciate your candor. It was actually published in 2016 and recently released a couple months ago, for paperback readers. On that note, how and why does your study approach the quote history of the autumn 1700 Owatobie massacre in terms of sources, the fragmented nature of the past, and the cyclical Bahana prophecy as a central agent, quoting you, in the perpetual tension of the Hopi historical imagination?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that if you look back at my whole kind of writing career and the books and essays I've produced, one of the questions that really haunts me and I think lies at the center of so much history is how do perfectly decent people do perfectly terrible things? I think that all of us are capable of being decent, and I think we're all capable of doing terrible things. And so I'm almost all of my work, especially looking at the slavery in the Southwest borderlands and different forms of kind of bondage and violation that way. have this question of when you stand in a different position, do you see the same event in different ways? And I thought the Iwatobi story was particularly intriguing in that there is a body of Spanish documentation, not a lot, but some, to help us understand kind of what was going on during that 80-year mission period and the run-up to the destruction of the Pueblo. There have been many oral historical accounts collected from Hopis since the 1870s, really, and up into the 1970s, like a century of oral accounts of the destruction that vary widely, shall we say, in their explanations and many of the details. And yet no one disputes that something big and traumatic and significant took place at Iwatobi Pueblo in the autumn of 1700. And so I was really intrigued as this as an opportunity to delve into this question and also do whatever I could as an outsider to find a way to tell the story based simply on the documentation that was available to me. And then I was very careful to draw a boundary around myself on this, even though that I, in my position, you know, I ran a school for advanced research for nearly a decade in Santa Fe, and we have many, many Hopi visitors and Hopi artists and residents and Hopi scholars. What I wanted to do was write a book that anybody with a library card could write, that I wanted to gather in one place for the first time all the published, available, publicly available material, whether it be issued by Hopis or issued by archaeologists or by historians, and see if there were some way of telling the story that would serve as a way of opening a conversation among Hopis privately that could easily exclude any outside ear to help resolve this is a deep and enduring trauma at Hopi, and some Hopis have said that this is the central dilemma in terms of sorting out the very notion of Hopiness is that the Hopis are supposed to be the peaceful people, and yet they at one point, at least, if not more, as you know from the book, have had to rely on these exercises of violence to somehow correct moments of what some see as chaos and licentiousness and immorality. So in one way, obviously for those who read the book, that this is, I think, kind of a universal human story. Certainly this is something that has happened in many, many places and many times when people destroy their own. And that's what the story's about. So,
thank you. Diving deeper into the book, in 1892, anthropologist Jesse Walter Fuchs sketched a site map of Iwatobi Pueblo high on the natural ramparts of Antelope Mesa. According to your assessment of his map, the site divided roughly between the west, where the massive mound of the main Pueblo rose several stories high, and the east, where the Franciscan church still showed standing walls and a mound of rooms suggesting an Indian residential block in close association with the Spanish mission. What did Fuchs hope to find at Iwatobi? And why did these aims reinforce the preconceptions of, as you argue, white Americans who saw the Indians of the Southwest as living antidotes to the frightening transformations of industrialization and untrammeled modernization?
Well, there's kind of two avenues of questioning there. The one, what was Jesse Fuchs trying to do by heading to the Antelope Mesa in 1892? He had a kind of a spotty career as an archaeologist. He's not terribly well respected for his field methods, that's for sure, if you read the book. But what he was also trying to do was to make a connection between what he saw as the scientific study of the past through the study of material culture, which is what archaeologists do, with the indigenous oral narratives and traditions and histories that had likewise been cultivated for centuries, right? So he thought, here, we have a case. We know that here is a village that has nearly, for at least four centuries of occupation represented in it. We know almost down to the day on which that village ceased to be occupied. And can we find evidence, if we excavate there, to support or, you know, contradict these Hopi narratives that had talked about the destruction, the necessity of the destruction of the village? And so he goes out and hires Hopi workmen, and he knows that at least some of the oral accounts say that the reason the attack succeeded was that it occurred during the days of the Wuutsim ceremony, which is the induction ceremony for young men or boys transitioning to manhood. That takes several days. There, everyone's down in the kivas, all the men are and the boys. And so there are no defenders there. And the way the Hopis tell the story is, and you'll see in the book, that the villages that fielded the columns that became the assailants knew this was going on, so the fighters lingered and hid overnight beneath the mesa, were signaled from within the village by, some say, the blazing of a torch, others say the snapping of a blanket, to enter the village and destroy it. And there's a gate that has been left guarded, unguarded, in the defensive wall. And so what Fuchs does is he, you know, plumbs the ground and finds what he would consider a depression for a kiva. And they excavate into that kiva, and sure enough, they find human remains. And his Hopi workmen promptly lay down their shovels and picks and go back to their villages and spend the night singing and building, making prayer sticks, and come back and lay those in the depression and say, we're not doing this anymore. So that's what he publishes in American Anthropologist, or the Bureau of American Ethnology, over the next two or three years, are these kind of snippets of this field work that he's conducted. So what he's trying to do is test the authenticity or the accuracy of Native oral tradition with archaeological field methods. So that's Fuchs's goal. Now, whether simultaneous to this, there's a growing fascination on the part of non-Indian Americans, generally white, generally middle class, generally educated Americans, who in the midst of kind of the period of high industry, the Gilded Age, the excesses, consumption, all this, look to the Southwest as a kind of an alternative model for the way societies can be composed. And it's generally presumed that Puebloan peoples are peace-loving, agricultural, ceremonially deeply devout people with relative gender balance in their communities, that there is no stratification. These are egalitarian societies, generally somehow democratic, though nobody quite understands how that works. And so the Southwest is this kind of magnet for a lot of seekers who come out in the late 1890s, so up through the 1920s, and really transform the Southwest. It's the reason New Mexico gains statehood, certainly, is that it finally raises the number of white settlers over the number of the white residents over the number of Hispano citizens, because people are really reluctant to bring New Mexico into the nation until after 1912, when the demographics work out. And among many of these migrants are young wealthy white women, and they become really the core for the cultural community that will shape even the New Mexico that we see today. That the white sisters, Horace Mann, Mann White's daughters, Miss Eve and her sister, they come out and they're heirs to the New York Post, Chicago Tribune. They buy 350 acres on the west side of Santa Fe. They go into the development business. They build homes. They become the foundation for what will ultimately become the Santa Fe Indian Market, Santa Fe Fiesta, the whole arts and cultural community there. And there are many, many women like this. They also ultimately grant the estate to the School of American Research, which is now the School for Advanced Research that I served as director for a good chunk of the 2000s. So there's this kind of tension between the imagined nature of Puebloan society and then what we see more and more often of late, the evidence we see on the ground, not only at Oahu, but all over the Southwest, of some pretty severe punctuation, shall we say, of violence and trauma and destruction. And that's kind of been the tension now for the last 10 or 20 years. How do we resolve these two very, very different understandings of who Puebloan people are and have been? Is that helpful?
Thank you. Yes. More specifically, these white women that you're talking about from New York and Boston relocated to New Mexico territory in search of, as you argue, another imagined model. The existence among the Pueblos of societies in which women wielded real social power. Can you elaborate on this possible exclusion of women, the actual exclusion of women from the great kivas at Chaco Canyon and after 1300 community level Katsina kivas?
Well, this that particular question has been developed much more over the last, but I don't know, maybe 15 years or so, by women anthropologists and archaeologists who, because of the disparities in power and along gender lines within the discipline, were much more sensitive to looking for evidence for inequalities of power in pre-Columbian societies. And Patricia Crown, back in the early 2001, through an SAR project, actually published probably still, I think, one of the best books on the question, called Women and Men in the Prehistoric Southwest, Labor, Power, and Prestige. And in general, you know, again, this is a gross simplification, but if you look at the early beginnings of what will become kind of the Puebloan societies that we think of today, that these are very, very small villages, hamlets. People are living almost entirely beneath the surface of the ground in what we call pit houses or pit structures that are subterranean. They have interlocking timber roofs, but it's a great place to live if it's either super cold or super hot wherever you are, because underground living is nice and stable. But in those, so let's say the 8th and 9th and 10th centuries, when you look at those, it appears to be that those are very much female spaces, and that they're residences, and women do, you know, the child rearing and food preparation and serving and the craft production and weaving, you know, whether it be basketry or you know, garments or whatever. But that the pit house is the model then for what will later, over the next several centuries, become what we call the kiva, the subterranean ceremonial chamber, which is kind of distinctly maybe different from a residential space, and at least in my looking at contemporary ethnography, largely a male space associated with male sodalities. And so it's somehow, in some way, something happens during the evolution of this form, this architectural form, that begins to remove women from kind of a central role, and it becomes a male space. And some people, and you can look at Patty Crown's book and some of the contributors there, see kind of the advent of Chaco Canyon, or the, what we might call the Chaco phenomenon, as a time when men seize and rise in power in the ceremonial sphere, and to the exclusion of women in that small, these small kind of domestic-like looking kivas become things like great kivas. And these great kivas are very, very much oriented toward major displays of performance of ceremonial functions. And if indeed we can look at more modern restrictions on women's access, women may have been excluded from that participation, because in the, at least in the Eastern Pueblos, most women are not allowed in kivas, and women aren't allowed to talk about the Katsina religion and things like that. So that's, you know, I only kind of hint at some of that, because that's a question that remains open. However, when you look at the Hopi narratives around the destruction of Oahu, many of them focus on, as one of the signs of kleanaskatsi, or corruption and decadence and disorder that is unfolding in the village, that many of them point to the presence of women in kivas. As a sure sign that something has gone terribly wrong. And so that's where I'm just piecing together various strands of thin evidence and hoping for the best in terms of building a deeper understanding of what happened there.
Moving on, you also argue that, quote, motivation toward violence was born of a profound fear of unseen and little understood power. Those whose power may in hidden knowledge, like the Chaco Canyon priest, in signs of cultural difference, like the Cowboy Wash community, or in supernatural struggles between old and new religions, as at Homolovi during the Katsina conversions, may have been marked for death. Thus was the fate of sorcerers, wizards, and witches in the Southwest. With the arrival of Franciscan missionaries beginning in the 1540 Hopi Mesas, numinous forces from afar stoked the fears of metaphysical threats of evangelical religion and intensified an ancient anxiety. As you've already alluded to, Hopi narratives of destruction, such as oral histories of the fall of Sikyaki village on the pre-Spanish First Mesa, all focus on young men's contests over a maiden as the trigger for the rise of sorcery and chaos. You contend that, at Sikyaki, this, quote, contest for the maiden's attention and services as wife highlights individual self-interest rather than the village's well-being, wholesale obliteration rather than select individual persecution, is the storm that washes away the corruption and brings a fresh dawn for renewal. Can you elucidate how cycles of evangelism, gender, perhaps sexuality, perhaps matrilineality, and definitely prophecy, reflected or did not reflect environmental as well as demographic renewal across the Hopi Mesas before and after 1540?
Well, that's a mouthful, Ryan. That's a big question. It's a great question, and again, one of these that's really difficult to resolve. That I think all students of shall we call it communal violence or intergroup violence, or would say that fear of the other, fear of the alien, fear of the intruder, fear of the immigrant, is a very, very deep trigger in the human makeup. And clearly, there are several points in the book where I talk about the amount of kind of intercultural migration that's going on in the Southwest during the period that Oahu is coming together and forming as a community in the 13th and 14th centuries, and how that constant movement of peoples, usually driven by regional or sub-regional crises in environment. The great drought in the Four Corners region from 1270 up and into into the 13th, 14th century is one, but there are many kind of micro environmental crises that unfold in the Southwest all the time, having lived there in a long time. You begin looking for those rain clouds come July, and they either show up or they don't in the summer monsoons. And if you're an agricultural people, depending on rain to bring your corn up out of the ground and to bring it to ripeness, everything depends on whether or not that happens. It also matters a lot if you have, let's say, enough corn stored from the previous good year to support your community, if let's say it's a village of 200 people, or if you have migrants on the horizon who may be another 40 or 60 or 80 people, and you think, wait a minute, how are we going to take care of these people? That, you know, there are powerful kinds of cultural affirmations of sharing and intergroup support that are also run through Puebloan society and the really admirable, wonderful qualities. But I try to make the point that in the book that this story that I'm telling here is very much a story about our present too. That if you want to see fear linked to violence, all you have to do is look at the politics of immigration in the United States today, and very, very ugly stuff that unfolds. So that I think is part of the universalness of this story, that this is not just a Hopi story or a Spanish colonial borderland story. It's a story that happens across time and space. There's also this notion of cycles of evangelism that I've played with both in this book, but also in earlier kind of more scholarly, entirely more boring work. And that is, I have always been struck when you look at accounts of when Spaniards first begin showing up in the Southwest from 1540 on. These columns, these sometimes big expeditions, like Coronado's expedition, has got hundreds and hundreds of people, thousands of livestock. They're completely crushing everything they walk across. But what you don't see Puebloan people doing is exhibiting shock and awe. You get a much more of a sense of, I like to say, it's like, oh God, here we go again. Years ago, I got to thinking maybe Catholicism was just another moment of evangelical invasion that people had experienced with the emergence of the Katsina religion in the 13th century that seems to have swept across the region in the period of a couple of generations at most, where everybody has adopted in some way or another aspects of the Katsina religion, whose origins are shady and much argued in Southwest archaeology. Some see it emanating up and out of the Central Valley of Mexico. Others see it very much kind of grown in place. But because of the perception today is that the Katsina ceremonial cycles and all are all about kind of harmony and peace and assuring fertility and abundance of crops, that it's always been a peaceful process. And in fact, when you look at the evidence, both of the timing of conflict in communities and petroglyphic evidence and whatnot, that first generation or two of the emergence of the Katsina religion is a really hard time in the Southwest. And there's a lot of evidence, a lot of iconography around violence and warfare. This is when there are many, many villages that are destroyed. And even Hopi accounts of the Katsinas early on represent them as these powerful, numinous figures that have the capacity to literally destroy a village if the village doesn't accept them. And I write about some of those in the book. So when Franciscans show up in their little brown robes, right, and a burro or two, like the Hopis are like, whatever. is like, here we go again. Let's see what they got, right? Let's see how this works. You know, maybe Katsina stuff worked out pretty good for us. Maybe we should listen to these guys a little bit. Because I talk about some of the earliest oral historical accounts we have is that of the village of Oraibi's experience with Franciscans. And they very clearly start out as they say, you know, for the first few years, it was pretty good. You know, it rained, crops were plentiful. We built some stuff for them. We helped them build a church. Everything was fine. And then things didn't go so well and the rain stopped. And suddenly Franciscan Catholicism didn't seem to be offering much. And so the tensions within that particular mission grew. And obviously across the landscape, they grew to the point that in 1680, you get this widespread revolt that expels the Franciscans. So I don't know if that really addresses everything you had in mind there.
Yes, it does. Thank you. I want to focus for a moment on a specific curse it was after the first Pueblo revolts, which began in 1680. The Walpi village of First Mesa, quote, needed to increase its strength. One strategy toward that end could draw upon a centuries deep custom on the Hopi Mesas, the addition of outsiders to their community. Despite the recruitment of the battle-tested fighters known as the Tano, Walpi village initially rejected approximately 400 migrants led by Agaitse. The Hopi chief did eventually offer, quote, a location north of Walpi village on First Mesa for a new village and allocated planting lands to the Tanos toward the east. And yet deep suspicions remained. When the Hopi chief reminded Agaitse that the agreement included the Tanos' right to take some of our women for wives, the Tano leader demurred. Agaitse feared that should Hopi women marry into the Tanos and tensions arose again, they might have to break apart. Frustrated, he laid down a curse with a strength embraced by all the descendants of the migration. But in those first years after the founding of this new village, the question of just where the Tanos would find wives to sustain and increase their numbers remained an open one. For our listeners, can you describe this curse and explain whether or not it would, quote, shape future relations between the Tanos and Hopis that endures today?
Well, this continues to be a very much a current tension on First Mesa, where you have two Hopi communities and what we call Tewa Village today. Was in the ethnographic times was called Tano, based on the fact that these folks are called or earlier term Tanos. They're a sub-branch of Tewa, come out of the Galisteo Basin south of Santa Fe for the most part. And there, my treatment of this migration story is largely drawn from descendant accounts from Tewa Village. So it, you know, I'll be the first to say that it has a pro-Tewa slant to it, because that's the best evidence that was available to me. They're not other Hopis from the other mesas, or even Walpi or Sicomovi, will say quite otherwise to how this unfolds. The one that is in the book is generally the one that you know we teach, and that is that the Hopis between 1680 and 1700 are feeling beleaguered not only by the return after 1693 of Spaniards, but are also being raided consistently by Utes and Comanches down, who come at harvest time, of course, wait for the harvest to be collected, and then raid villages, take the corn, take women, take children as captives. Sometimes they resell them to Spaniards. And then there's a lot of evidence, actually, of intra-village tension at Hopi as well, that there are kind of conflicts between villagers. So the folks at Walpi who are feeling very distraught. I send emissaries into, east to the Rio Grande to talk to people who have survived the Pueblo Revolt. They actually were key players and fighters in the revolt. And they solicit, according to these stories, the migration of Tanos or Tewas out to take up a village on the north side of First Mesa and to act as guardians of that northern gate. Because they're battle proven. They have just been implicated in and punished for participating in the short-lived 1696 Pueblo Revolt. There's two, the big successful one in 1680 and then a much less successful one in 96. And so some large group of migrants, perhaps, 300-500 people, do come out to the mesas. And then this very, very difficult negotiation ensues of that one can imagine why, on the one hand, maybe Hopis want to have some additional military support. On the other hand, they don't want, one, to be looked down upon. They don't want to be seen themselves as not functional fighters. They've already proven themselves in many occasions as perfectly, good field warriors. And so that the attention is developed there at First Mesa during these kind of negotiations between Pininwalpi and Dewa Village that ultimately ends up involving a curse that's laid down by the Tano leader, Agatsai, who says that we will learn Hopi in order to live here and be the guardians of the Northern Gate, and we will participate in the ceremonial calendar, we'll bring our calendar, we'll meld it with yours. We will fulfill our part of the agreement. However, you will never learn Tewa. And thus we will protect our independence as Tewa people in ways that will guard the language, at least, as being particular to our identity. And in general, this has proven to be true, that if you look at contemporary ethnographies of First Mesa, for the most folks at Tewa Village, they speak or know Hopi, they know Spanish, they know English, they're 21st century people. But on the other hand, Hopis kind of don't try too hard to learn Tewa. And one could argue what's going on here is actually two forms of kind of identity and boundary maintenance. On the one hand, people kind of trying to reserve a language to themselves. But on the other hand, people saying, hey, we don't want to learn your language. It's like only English is spoken here, right? But it's emblematic, I think, in some ways of the kinds of tensions that can develop between communities, whether they be 300 years ago or tomorrow, around issues of strength, pride, gender, intermarriage, all of these things are implicated there. And the final sentence in Mesa of Sorrows at the end of my acknowledgments says really that what this book is about, or the lesson of this book, is very simple. It's that let us try not to make strangers of our kinfolk and neighbors. That's the takeaway, that because when we do, bad stuff happens. So that's my shot on that one. I have subsequently been told by folks from Walpi that all those Tewas are nothing. They came as beggars. They came as defeated fugitives from 1696 revolt. And we only took them in because we thought they might be useful. So there are many, many different ways of rendering the story, and my friends at Walpi feel differently than my friends at Tewa. So
I want to touch, thank you. I want to touch briefly on Albert Yaba's narrative. I believe I found one that was
right. Yeah. There's our, you know, that's why we have a Tewa version of the migration, because Yaba's narrative is rich and wonderful, and for it's a historian's dream.
Yeah, exactly. So he indicates that the Walpi war chief and Don Francisco, the Rabi Cacique, on behalf of the Awatobi Bow Clan Kikmongwe Tapolo, agreed to obliterate Awatobi and purify it of factionalism between traditionalists and Catholic neophytes. The latter converts purportedly disrupted Katsina ceremonies, perhaps in the wake of the May 1700 baptism of 73 Awatobi peoples by a visiting padre. How did documentary evidence of Don Francisco's, by the way, Don Francisco, we mentioned earlier in the introduction, Padre Espalata's probable murderer, post 1696. So after the second or third phase of the, yeah. How did his liminal role as Badger Clan informant and Catholic convert substantiate or did not substantiate or both Yaba's narrative? How did it correspond? And then in that context, you also argue that witnessing at Awatobi the emergence of a heterodox experimental piety that posed an alternative to the practice of Orthodox Hopi religion, the entrenched spiritual and political leadership sense the end of the world fast approaching. How, in that context, can you discuss a little bit as well the young European man found underneath the altar of the Mission San Bernardo?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are kind of, they're related. They're two pretty different lines of evidence that this character who the Spanish call Don Francisco Espeleta, who knows what he's called, you know, he never shows up. Certainly Hopis know about this guy. They're very reluctant to talk about him for obvious reasons. He appears to probably have been a godchild of Padre José de Espeleta, who was a key member, a key part of the emergence of this notion of Awatobi as the singing house, and that he brought Carl singing. There were a lot of bad padres at the Hopi Mesas. However, Espeleta does not appear to have been one. He seems to have been pretty well respected. However, Francisco de Espeleta, the godson, one, he speaks Spanish. He appears to have had perhaps even some education in Mexico. He may have been sent to Mexico and back. He comes back at some point in 1670s, because I think it's 64 that he's probably being trained up under the Franciscans. And he seems to have kind of changed his position on Franciscan missions to the Hopi. And the Spanish accounts refer to him as the cacique, or what Hopis might call the Kikmongwe, the crier chief of Oribe Village, which is the other big village out on the mesas. In many ways, it's a rival to Awatobi. And I talk some about that in the book, that even Hopis today talk about the rivalry for this command of the ceremonial calendar, that sort of thing between the two villages. So Espeleta is really curious. Maybe he did, you know, slay his own godfather in 1680. That some accounts have that. But the thing where I find him most fascinating is, as you know, having read the book, that there's this key moment in the run-up to the destruction of the village that takes place roughly a month before the village is destroyed. And that's when a whole delegation of perhaps 30 Hopi leaders go all the way to Santa Fe in October, which is not necessarily a great time to travel, and certainly not on foot. And, you know, this is a long trip. This is several weeks to get to Santa Fe to have an audience with Governor Cubero. And Espeleta, Don Francisco, is the spokesperson and lays out a proposal in front of the governor that I interpret as an attempt to kind of manage the interaction between the Spanish colony, Franciscans, and the Hopis in such a way to keep tensions at their very lowest, to diffuse this kind of danger of the explosive violence that everyone feels is coming because of the prophetic nature of history out at Hopi. And as I try to suggest in the book, you know, if there's blood on anybody's hands in this story, it's really on Cubero, who just dismisses this delegation's proposal as like, who do you think you are that you've already accepted submission to the Spanish crown by my act of reconquest, or by, you know, de Vargas's act of reconquest? You don't come to me with proposals, you come to me with submission. So he just throws this out and dismisses the whole delegation and sends them home. And, you know, surprise, surprise, 30 days later, the community of Awatavi is destroyed by other Hopis. So Hopis have told me that he was, Espeleta was underground for his whole career with the Franciscans, that his role was as a kind of infiltrator and spy. And so he was trained up for this role. And I haven't seen that, you know, because of the parameters I put on the book, that I only work with published documentary kind of sources. I didn't use any of that material, but because much of what I try to say in the book is that, hey, this is one guy's understanding of what happened. Now the field is open, that I've gathered all the materials available to somebody with a library card. Now Hopis can tell their own story whenever, if and when they want to. So that's one part of your question. The other is this mysterious burial that the Peabody expedition finds in the 1930s when they do go out and do this extensive multi-year excavation at the community. It begins, as you know, with, I think, a perfectly reasonable research plan, and that was that here you finally have a site where you know that there's bedrock at the top of that mesa, and then a whole bunch of cultural deposits, and you know exactly the moment, or the year at least, when it's no longer occupied. So it's a perfect opportunity to develop material culture typology and chronology for that region. And that was what the director of the project, Joe Brew, sought to do when he first went out there. It shifts because of internal Anglo politics, because of pressure by the Catholic Church to an excavation of the Mission San Bernardo de Awatabi church and convento complex. And in the process of that, they uncover in a makeshift altar on the side of the nave what is determined to be the remains of a young European man, roughly 20, 21 years old. He has there are certain kind of key characteristics and skeletal formation that call him a young man. We do not know why he was designated a European man, presumably because he lacked the shovel-shaped incisors that supposedly distinguish between Indians and whites. However, you know, the mystery here is there's no record of in the Spanish mission of a young European male being associated with the mission. It also is quite clear that he has died post 1680. He's part of this kind of elaborate and complex reuse and continuing use of a destroyed church for interments. He's also super mysterious because, unlike the Hopis who are buried in the church nave, who have been buried in a Western kind of Christian fashion as extended burials, with an assortment of mixed both Catholic and Hopi burial goods. This young man is actually a secondary burial in that his body, his bones are picked clean. He's been bundled up, wrapped in a Hopi cloth, but a cloth that is kind of modeled on the Franciscan robe. He has a woven belt that's very much modeled on the Franciscan classic belt. And yet he's placed on a Hopi basket in this bundled form and deposited in this kind of altar space. It doesn't show up in any of the Hopi narratives that have ever surfaced. There's no explanation for him. The folks from the Peabody don't know what to do with him. They send the body to Cambridge for identification as a young European male, and then suddenly find themselves in the midst of a kind of firestorm of politics because the Reverend Victor Stoner down in Tucson, Catholic secular priest and an avid archaeologist, gets wind of this burial and decides that the young man must be evidence of martyrdom during the Pueblo Revolt. So he proposes that the site of Owatobi be turned into a national monument in honor of the the Franciscans who died in the revolt, that these ought to be honored as somehow people who have experienced the worst. And he says that the Peabody expedition ought to halt their excavations in the church because they're destroying the shrine of a martyr. So the Peabody folks don't know what to do and point out that this is probably almost certainly a post-revolt interment, that he couldn't have died in the rebellion. Nobody knows who he is, so it's pretty hard to declare him a martyr. And yet everybody gets involved. We have senators, we have directors of the interior, we have all sorts of politics going on. So finally, Joe Brew, the director of the expedition, ship returns. He does this is the great irony for anybody who's an archaeologist listening in, that the first repatriation of human remains in North American archaeology is not of an indigenous person to an indigenous community, but of a white man to a Catholic church. He ships it off to the mission at St. Michael's. It's received. We have documentation. The priest at St. Michael's is overcome with joy. Yeah, he weeps because he's received the body of this martyr. Everybody is delighted. And somehow they managed to lose him over the years. This guy does not show up in any inventory at mission at St. Michael's. I've talked to folks who are in charge of that whole province, the Guadalupe province. They have no idea what became of him. So we don't know even what contemporary, what might modern physical anthropology and osteological exploration be able to say about this guy. That the suggestion I've heard most often is that he's probably the offspring of a Franciscan priest and a Hopi woman who plays some kind of a mediative interdisciplinary or interstitial role in between Catholicism and Hopi practice, and that he may have been associated with whatever kinds of hybrid forms of piety or experimental piety, as I call it in the book, that was going on there. But so there's a really long answer to your question.
It's a great. It's actually really fascinating question. yeah. On the eve of the killings of Owatobi, Don Francisco, the rejected delegation that you mentioned, may have heard that friars had constructed a new Owatobi church in the convento. removing several Hopi alterations. In the late 30s, the Peabody expedition, the archaeological expedition, revealed that the friars had also hastily begun construction of military barracks to house Spanish cavalry soldiers. You argue that it seems likely that the Franciscans had become aware of the imminent arrival of the Tano migrants recruited by the Walpi that we discussed, perhaps only by rumor. Can you explain how this built environment and refugees pouring into the Hopi community contributed or didn't contribute to the perfect storm that resulted in plans for fulfillment of the Pahana prophecy and subsequent killings at Awatobi?
Sure. I think it's really important to, the Tano migration is the one that always people talk about, is because it's kind of endured in a way that, you know, there is a Tewa village up there on First Mesa and a distinct long serving community. But between 1680 and 1700, if we want to use that as the pivotal year, you know, there are many refugee communities coming into the Hopi Mesas, fleeing the Rio Grande. There are Tiwas coming. There are northern Tiwas and southern Tiwas. We have additional Tewa migrations, and we have villages that form out there on the mesas. That are kind of, you know, it's like you're accepted, but geez, this is getting really crowded here. And if we have a bad year, this is going to get bad. So, and these are folks who have had a much deeper immersion in Spanish colonial life since they're coming from the Rio Grande region. And although they probably are bringing unhappy memories of the Spanish times, they are Hispanicized at some level. You know, there's a tremendous amount of intermarriage already by the time of the 1680 revolt. There are a lot of mestizo Pueblo Spaniards in the public communities. And so if you're Hopi, here you are, you know, you're 350 some miles from the Rio Grande, and you're really glad you are a long way away because you don't want to be a part of anything that's going on over there. And yet refugees start showing up on your doorstep. Now, that should sound familiar to us today. If you're Western Europe or United States and you're getting Syrian refugees and Kurdish refugees, you know, these are conflicts that in some ways are completely divorced from everyday life, and yet they're transforming your everyday life because people who are arriving, and, you know, that most human societies have an ethic of acceptance and sharing and generosity, that's kind of how we learn to get along. And yet there are these points where people feel the limits there's one community of Tiwas that even today, Hopis will say, oh, they were spies when they came here. We discovered they were spies, and so we drove them out. So here you are at Hopi. You know there's been some odd doings at Huarvi for the last 20 years, right? Not sure what they are. Interesting, since the book has come out, you know, I've done workshops with the Hopi Cultural Preservation Office for Hopi, Hopi member. Any Hopi tribal member can have a copy of the book for free. We've given away, I think, 86 at this point. One of the associate judges for the Hopi tribal courts, who's a direct lineal descendant of Tatpolo, is tobacco keeper at Walpi, Judge Delford Leslie. He uses now the book and the case as a way of talking about intra-community conflict and conflict resolution, things like that. But imagine that you're out there, you know that there's been this brief visitation in May of 1700 by Padre Garcia and some two or three other padres, probably with a small military escort, though it's not we're not absolutely sure. They've cleaned up a portion of the old convento and kind of created a makeshift nave and church out of it. They put in a new baptismal font, things like that. Then left. They supposedly baptized 70 some kids. Then they leave. But they leave with solid evidence that they're also constructing a military barracks there that could house up to 12 soldiers. And once that news circulates, I think the whole level of concern, you know, skyrockets, because one of the enigmas of the whole Spanish colonial period and the pre-revolt period is the success of these missions from 1626 on, in terms of not having military personnel associated with them. The only one that really had a detail assigned to it was up at Pecos. Otherwise, you know, all this labor and all these transitions that we associate with the mission area happened without, you know, people that, yes, they certainly brought Indians from other communities in as capitanes de guerra, you know, people to kind of provide muscle, but it was mostly indigenous, you know, collaborators, what do you want to call them? So the fact that there's a barracks under construction for, if you really had 12 soldiers assigned, that would probably be like one of the big, probably the biggest military statement on the colony of New Mexico outside of Santa Fe. So then you get word that the Taínos are migrating, coming out to join the Hopis. That's got to make you very nervous. And you also really, if you're Hopi, you think, wait, oh, there, you know, there's some additional muscle for us. Maybe that's important. And you ask about the evidence of Taíno participation in the destruction of Ouatabi, and there's evidence on both sides. And that's it's not up to me to make that call.
Do you think is there any evidence that this is a brief follow-up question, that the Tewa village Taíno that we discussed earlier, who were searching for wives to sustain their numbers, is there any evidence or anything to indicate that they participated?
That's a great question, because one of the things that we do know is that there are what are called Ouatabi clans in Hopi villages. And they are clustered predominantly in the three villages that fielded warriors, the Walpi, Mshongabi, and Ribi. And the only way you can have a clan appear in a village is if a female clan member comes in and brings their clan with her and begins to reproduce, you know, clans people. There are Ouatabi clans at Tewa village. However, that could have also, you know, Tewas are much, you know, they may have intermarried a century later. There are people obviously who know, and that's their business. I don't think it changes the story any in any way, and it doesn't change the significance of the story that I tell in any way. Obviously, it's important, but it's important for other reasons. Then
the core was probably, I don't know, may have, I guess it doesn't really matter, but it probably was Don Francisco and the Ouatabi warriors. I was just wondering.
Probably, though, you know, how he ends up being a cacique of Ouatabi if he's from Ouatabi, that doesn't quite make sense. But he's clearly not at Ouatabi, and Ouatabi is the big rival. It's the big, powerful rival. So he's chosen well. But he's also, I think, proposing a pretty reasonable conciliatory plan in October. If indeed, you know, that delegation, if it's fairly represented in the Spanish documents, that was a more than reasonable proposal to deal with the tensions. And that is that the Spaniards could visit once a year. Franciscans could come, and they could come to one settlement each year. They could preach, they could baptize, do whatever they wanted, and then they would go away. And the next year, they would come to a different settlement and go through the same thing. And, you know, one could argue that this is a way of kind of managing interactions between maybe still Catholic sympathizers out at Hopi that they get to once a year have their children baptized, right? There, you know, it may be, but you know, I don't think we're ever going to know, but it seemed to me that it bore remarking, upon, as an effort on the part of Hopi leadership to prevent what they knew was going to happen if something didn't work out. And I've tried to really forefront that in all the public talks I've given around this is, you know, one of the things leaders are supposed to do is do the right thing, right? They're supposed to solve problems and prevent violence instead of stoking it, right? And it seems to me that the Hopi leadership went above and beyond that kind of call to duty, that they really did try to find a way that this might not happen, and Cubero rejects them just because of out of the arrogance of, you know, Spaniards still, even after the punishment they took in 1680, have the arrogance of imperialists, and that is that, well, come on, we're the winners, right? We came back, we defeated you, and you need to be subservient to us now. When in fact, the reconquest is very much a negotiated affair, that Spaniards promised to be very different, and Franciscans promised to be very different, and Pueblos promised to be good, trusty military auxiliaries in dealing with people like Apaches and Comanches, because that's a lot of why they allowed that to happen, because Comanches have become by 1700 a really scary threat to the outskirts of the Puebloan world, or in, you know, even inside the Puebloan world.
So finally, can you elaborate on the conclusion that even after the 1700 Iwatobi killings, Iwatobi did not die? Neither too would Christianity be forever excluded from the mesas.
Well, Iwatobi as a community, yes, I think, you know, did die. It was never reoccupied, although clans still have claims to cornfields and peach orchards. That one of the things I have, you know, in the book is that some of the women of Iwatobi were not taken captive and fled the Mesa and were absorbed into the Navajos down in Jedido Wash. And that's why you have these small inholding Navajo communities inside the Hopi Reservation, the Jedido Island and down at in the Butte country, there's a couple down there, and it's because they're recognized as being kin to Hopis. So the lines, the clans from Iwatobi have continued to exist. And, you know, you will hear, well, we threw that, you know, we expelled the Spaniards in 1680 and the Franciscans, and we never allowed Catholicism back. That's kind of true, but there is a small Catholic community at Hopi. There's certainly many Christian sects. The first Mormon missions to the Hopi were in the 1850s. I think Jacob Hamlin goes down there in late 50s. He converts one of the leaders, a fellow named Tuva, who brings his followers then out to where, that's where Tuba City, Arizona, gets its name, is from that Hopi man's name, Tuva. So you have a whole contingent of Mormon Hopis living by certainly the late 19th century. You have a lot of Pentecostal Christians among Hopis who are also completely comfortable with observing their duties and responsibilities in the ceremonial calendar as well. There's a fabulous Katsina Carver, Armin Fritz at First Mesa, who is he's the keeper of the Bluebird Clan migration story, but he's also a leading member of the Pentecostal Church down in Palaka. So, and one of the things that kind of makes me crazy as a teacher is people think that Indigenous peoples have to be either 100%, you know, committed to Indigenous spirituality, or they've sold out by becoming Christian. And there's plenty of evidence in the Pueblo world that people can observe both quite comfortably. And what's wrong with that? Seems like to me a pretty good solution in many ways. So I think that's what I meant by that closing line.
Thanks for the clarification. I actually have one final question. What can we expect from you next that you can disclose?
Oh my! Well, this is what I'm doing at the Robert Penn Warren Center at Vanderbilt this year. Was working on a new book that I've long kind of puzzled and wanted to do. It's called Picket Wire, which is a kind of country Anglo perversion of the French word purgatoire or purgatory. And it's set in the New Mexico-Colorado borderlands of Las Animas and Huerfano counties of Colorado. I've long wanted to write a story that combines indigenous histories, Hispano history, and labor history with the kind of the more dominant, like Anglo-American story, kind of a national story. And it has just so happens that this location is the perfect place to do it. And it also has this wonderful river called the Purgatory River, or the what locals call the Picket Wire. And the overarching kind of message of this many generation intertwined families book is that all of us dwell in purgatory because everybody has blood on our hands and we're never going to wash it off. So that's what I'm trying to do.
Thank you, Professor Brooks. That concludes for your time today. That concludes our podcast on Mesa of Sorrows, the killings at Awatobi. Stay tuned for next time. I thank all our listeners. And of course, I thank Professor Brooks. And we'll.
It's been my pleasure, Ryan. Thank you.
All right. Tune in next time. Thanks.